If you're looking for the perfect gift, you're covered with a gift that's sure to wow. Taste of Chicago ships Lou Malnati's legendary deep dish pizzas nationwide. Plus, they ship other Windy City favorites too. Visit tasteofchicago.com to order today.
Well, welcome to an interesting, strange edition of After Hours with me, Rick Cogan. It is, we're going to be on at 5, and now we're going to be on until 7, from 5:30 until 7. The first hour is a very special hour for me, because it's been some time since I have entertained my friend, my mentor, an inspiration to me for many years, Father John Cusick. He's retired now, so I never know what to call him. grandfather or father or father this. We met when he was at...
When did we meet?
It certainly wasn't at a golf course. I know that.
No. Where we met, believe it or not, was at the baptism of your daughter at Old St. Patrick's Church. You know, everyone was looking to see if the ceiling would hold. I remember that. And she's now, what, 21?
She'll be 21 this year, yes.
That's right. See,
yes,
I'm
she will. Well, if that, you know, I don't know much about baptism, obviously.
Obviously.
But if that had anything to do with turning her into a good, young, nice young woman, I'm all for it.
Well, that's fun, because I met your mother.
Wow, that's right.
I met your brother.
Mary Lou is still alive.
That's right. Right.
Wow. Wow. You know? And we have had a lovely, wonderful relationship ever since.
We've had fun.
Some drinks, some golf.
Yeah.
A lot of talking, though, John. You and I have, I don't want to, you know, sort of cast us as nickel and dime philosophers, but we talk about life all the time.
We do. And I think I just honor the fact that you and I can do that.
Yeah.
And we've had some very in-depth conversations about some pretty serious things.
No question. Because when you look at what has happened, and I especially look at your life, your time in the church from the time you started to be kind of devoted to the church as a young guy growing up on the south side, the church has undergone I'm not even going to call it radical change. I'm going to call it like earth-shattering changes. Not only to do with criminal activities, but also to do with the internet and everything else, and family dynamics and everything else. Take me back, John Cusick, will you please, to the little boy that you were growing up, as you always put it, on the wrong side of the tracks in Beverly. Right.
Well, even prior to my tenure as the assistant caddy master at Beverly Country Club, when I was younger, I was a church rat. I lived three blocks from Little Flower, which was at 80th and Wood. And as a little Catholic kid, I served all religious services. I would serve funerals, weddings, any kind of thing that moved and walked, I'm there.
Why was that? I mean,
because I enjoyed it. I had a good time.
This was your kind of pastime. This was your fun.
Yeah. But I play. I mean,
but there was also. I mean, it's interesting to me because at that age, there's also some responsibility going with that. It's not exactly like going to the park to play baseball. There's
no
responsibility.
But I did that too, and I played Little League, and I had what I believed was sort of a well-rounded time as a kid.
Mm.
And a lot of it revolved around church.
How often did your parents go to church?
Oh, every Sunday. My mother more. My dad worked for the Rock Island Railroad, so he would be on the train at Brainerd Station on the south side. But I remember going to church with my mother when we lived over another parish east at St. Sabina's, and I was only like 4 or 5 years old, and my memory goes back that far.
Take me back then. I'm not sure I've ever even asked you about this. Take me back to your, if you can, to your first memories of church. You know, I don't really have any because I ever got in church. But there's something unbelievably majestic about the setting.
Right. The setting was, and everything about it, it was your DNA.
Mm-hmm.
But there was a happening, and I can talk about it now because the person very important in my life has passed away.
Mm-hmm.
But I'll do it at the end and work back to it.
Okay.
I got a phone call one day. I was at St. Pat's already over here at Adams and the Splains, and I'll leave the priest's name out of it. But he called me up and he said, John, this is Father so-and-so. And, you know, I've been thinking, I buried one of my brothers the other day, and I'm thinking I'm not going to live forever, and I'm going to write this out, but I'm calling because I want you to speak at my funeral.
Mm.
And I said to him, I said, Father, you're the reason I went into seminary.
Wow.
When I was in grade school. And then, so I went into the high school seminary, Quigley, over here at 103
East Chestnut. Let me ask you about this man without naming him, but what was it about him that so inspired you?
He was in charge of the altar boys.
Uh-huh.
He liked me. I looked up to him, and I'm saying, I could do that. You know, and those were the kind of mentors, as you mentioned the word earlier, that meant an awful lot to me. But what was funny is, as I was in the seminary, this guy I discovered, this priest, did not have a good reputation in the archdiocese.
For what?
People called him lazy, and he didn't work hard, and on and on. And I'm sitting there saying, this is my hero.
Yeah.
What are you talking about? You know, and so I said to him on that same phone call, you know, I said, Father, you're the reason I went into the seminary. And by God, many years later, I preached at his funeral.
Wow.
Because I looked up to him, and then he said something on that phone call, which really sort of got to my heart. After I told him he was the reason I went into the seminary, he said, John, that's why I called you today. I want to be remembered for doing at least one thing right.
Wow.
Oh, my God. You know?
Wow.
Yeah. Never forget that.
What did your parents say when you said, whatever age it was, and I'm sure that many, many people will, it's the wrong word to use, but will flirt with a religious life. When you told your parents, Mom, Dad, I think I want to be a priest.
It didn't bother them.
What did they say?
My dad.
Said, there's no money in that. What are you talking about?
No. My dad was hysterical after I was in the seminary for a while. One day he said to me, John, if you ever want to leave, that's okay. I mean, he was a character.
Yeah.
You know, he was never saying, oh, you know, another year, isn't this wonderful? I don't know. No, if you ever want to leave, that's okay. So, I'll never forget that. And I think, because my dad was a saloon drinker on 79th Street, I'm pretty sure we were sitting in a bar.
Yeah.
Because some of my greatest memories of being one-on-one with my dad, you know,
sure,
were not in the backyard. They were in the bar.
Wow.
And ironically, he died when at age 59, and I was very young. But when he would have been 100, I drove through the old neighborhoods looking for the saloons.
And they were gone.
They were all gone. But I had more fun that night. Oh, my God, we drank there and we drank there. But that's how I remember him. And he was supportive of me in one of those, you know, negative kind of ways.
Sure.
You know.
Did you ever, in your early days in seminary and preparing for the life that you've had, is second thoughts at all during any of that?
You always have second thoughts. I'm sure you've had second thoughts being a writer. Even
every day.
You had second thoughts of driving a cab.
Every day. Every day. I have second thoughts about breathing.
Second thoughts are part of human nature.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there are days when I would look up to somebody and say, I could never be like that. You know, I could never that. I remember something you said to me not that many years ago. Because when I retired, I started writing a little bit.
I remember.
And I had writer's block, and I got into a mode of, I can't do this, I can't do this, I could never be Rick Hogan. And you remember, one day you just said to me,
"You don't want to be Rick Kogan."
No, no, no. If I ever could be half the writer you are. But you said to me, "Just write."
Mm-hmm.
Because I said, "Rick, I talk for a living. I don't write." You said, "Just put things on paper and just keep putting." And basically, I followed your advice, and I just started putting things in a computer. And I honed that part of the English language because I, as someone who's been a public speaker for 54 years, writing and speaking are two completely different forms of the English language.
But I will tell you something, my friend. One of the things that impressed me to the point of being flabbergasted was when I learned, and I had heard over the years in getting to know you and getting to know people who went to Old St. Pat's and getting to know people who sat and listened to your sermons and the other things you said, what a brilliant orator you were. And when I found out that you did not write those things, I had to have you, and I'll do it right now. How is that possible, John? Would you get a seed of some topical notion, some seasonal notion, and ideas would form in your head?
I never know. You see, in the Catholic Church, you just can't get up and talk. The scripture readings are laid out for us,
right,
over a 2-year or a 3-year cycle. And so I have to open the book and say, you know, what's the gospel going to be like for today?
Okay.
And I read it and say, okay, now what? Because I don't have an idea. But then with that running in my head, it's like fishing with a net. I can just roam around and pull things and see if that will work or that will work. And if I can get an idea and it sounds palatable, I'll just run with it. And some weeks I can feel two parts of my brain. This is going to sound like I'm really at the edge of the rope here. But I can feel part of my head is thinking as I talk. But then if I say something that, oh, that sounds pretty good, I will file it in the back of my head and bring it back later.
Wow.
And that's just how I'm wired. Like today I was very serious today. And I was being hard on myself. I knew exactly what I was trying to do. Because it's not just words. You're trying to communicate yourself. You're transparent to 1,000 people.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And so I got it across, and I'm saying to myself, that wasn't bad today.
What was it about?
See, I can't.
I mean, I'm not going to ask you to do it again. Yes.
No, I can't remember because it's gone.
Do none of these ever get recorded?
I don't know.
Oh, wow.
I have no idea. You know, it's never
is one of a kind. You've known hundreds of other priests.
Oh yeah,
thousands maybe.
Yeah.
Have you ever met another one who operates in this kind of what I'm going to say seat of the pants fashion?
I've never really asked them. I'm sure there are some that are out there.
Yeah.
But I have a very maybe part of it is I've always had in my life a very fertile imagination. And I claim part of that is being an only child.
Right.
I had to make my own fun.
Right.
I remember I would come home from school when I was really, you know, maybe 10, and I could turn our apartment on the south side into a canyon where I could play a cop or a cowboy, and you'd hide behind the sofa, and it was like hiding behind rocks. I had a very fertile imagination. And I just took that into my adult life.
Wow. We are talking and spending this entire hour with Father John Cusick. You don't mind being still called Father John Cusick, do you?
Whatever you want to call me.
No, I want to be proper. I want to be precise. I was.
And you'll always be Mr. Kogan.
I was never so interested as when John retired. What do I call you now? We'll take a little commercial break and come back and continue this this conversation.
We have to talk about Christmas.
When is Christmas? Yeah, we'll talk about Christmas. I like talking about you, though. We'll be back in a couple minutes. Welcome back. I'm talking to John Cusick because I can't stop talking to John Cusick, and I'll talk to him in front of all of you, in front of all of you listeners. John was asking why you haven't started talking about Christmas yet, because we were talking about his childhood. I know I've never asked you this question, Father Cusick. What is your first Christmas memory?
My first adult Christmas memory was the Christmas of 1970. I was ordained a Catholic priest in May, and in my head, I had to find some gift for my parents as a way of symbolically and really thanking them for all the things they did for me over the previous 12 years. And I decided I knew exactly what it was. Now, my mother always liked a lot of boxes. I'd have to show up coming at home, and I couldn't just walk in with a gift card.
An envelope.
Yeah, no, that wouldn't work. But this Christmas of 1970... I showed up with a tie box, and that was it. And, of course, her antenna went up like, what in the name of God is going on? My father could care less.
Yeah.
So I told them, sit over on the sofa next to each other, and I handed them the tie box. And I said, okay, now you can open it. And in the tie box were airline tickets, hotel accommodations, for Florida and the Bahamas. And the reason for that is they stopped taking a vacation in my last 4 to 5 years in the seminary because I was an adult and I had no money.
Yeah.
And they paid for all my expenses and did not take a vacation themselves. So I needed to give back as a Christmas gift. The most important thing I could give them was time with themselves, out of the cold, and I said, I will meet you in Miami. We spent 2 days together, and then they had the rest of the time to themselves. And that's the most significant Christmas. That's the greatest gift I could have given to my mom and dad. My dad cried.
I'm almost crying.
Yeah, and my dad cried twice in 6 months, the only two times I saw him cry was in May of 1970 and Christmas morning of 1970.
Wow.
Yep.
What happened in May?
I was ordained.
Oh, okay.
You know, so, yeah, I remember he hugged me and I could feel
John,
the tears coming down his eyes. And my dad was a tough Southside drinking guy.
Sure,
you know?
Sure.
And, but that Christmas, I'll never forget it. And hindsight, that was his last Christmas. He died at the end of September 1971.
No.
Yep. So that was the last gift I could have given him, to he and my mom. So that,
boy, that gift is so freighted with all sorts of
emotion. Oh my God, it's
meaning
loaded
and
loaded with imagery and meaning and you know, and I thought nothing of it. I, you know, handed him a tie box.
Yeah. Yeah, but that's kind of creative gift-giving, I think.
Yeah, but that's my most memorable Christmas.
How much longer did your mom live?
My dad died at 59. My mother died at 97.5.
Wow.
So she lived another 30 years, and it began the best, I think. I'm very, very biased on this. I think it was the best 30 years of her life.
Why?
Because she came alive in a different kind of way.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
We could travel together. And one night we were out for dinner right after my dad died. And it was a tough time for both of us.
Sure.
And then she said to me, John, you know, your dad had a dream. And he never lived to see it ever happen. I said, well, what was the dream? He always wanted to go to Europe. But then when you go back and realize, why did they didn't go? Because they were covering for my expenses. She said, and this was classic, my mother. She said, let's sell the house, take some of the money, and go to Europe.
And did you?
Yeah.
Oh, my God. Oh,
my dad didn't leave her any money.
Yeah.
And the only thing we could do was sell the house. And we spent 22 days wandering around Europe and came back, and she moved into an apartment where she lived for 29 years.
Oh, my God.
Until the day she died.
South side?
Yep. No. North side. My mother was a North sider.
Oh, she was?
Yes. My dad was the South sider. So she went south to save his soul.
And she obviously did a good job.
Yeah. And then she went back north. And we just had a great time together.
Yeah, I know you guys were very, very, very close.
Yeah.
Well, we have heard the story of John Cusick's Christmas. When we come back after the news, we'll talk a little bit about. I saw a really disheartening documentary that was part of Mike Houlihan's Irish American Film Festival about what has happened to church going and confessions in Ireland in the wake of certain
issues.
Thank you. Certain issues, and it was really heartbreaking. They visited church after church after church where the confessional booths, are they called? Confessional booths were now being used as storage spaces because no one went there, and it was really something. And whenever I have questions like that about things like that, you're the person I go to, John. You can look up John Cusick, Cusick, because he has a number of, how many books do you have now?
I think two or three, that's all.
Oh, two or three, yeah. This from, I don't know how to write, Rick, inspire me. Yeah, two or three now.
But
two
you
or three
did.
Now, yeah. Here, ladies and gentlemen, is the news. Welcome back to a new strange edition of After Hours with me, Rick Hogan, and my guest, Father John Cusick of Old St. Pat's. One of the fascinating things about your career, John, is how you and Jack Wall resurrected. You brought Old St. Pat's back from it's a building, I know that, but back from near death, didn't you?
First time Jack was there, Sunday in 1983, there were 25 people at Mass.
Wow.
And there were four people who would technically be called members. And within 6 months, you couldn't get in the door.
Why?
Well, you have to have, like any business. I mean, you're with the Tribune, and you got to know how to sell papers.
A so-called business, yes.
Yeah, but you got to know how to sell papers, and other people, whatever your business is, you got to have some kind of a dream. And Jack said, we will make this a church for the city. Catholicism is all these parishes have boundaries.
Right.
And St. Pat's technically had boundaries, but we didn't know what they were. And
well, because it took in parts of Skid Row. And
it took in everything.
Yeah.
You know, and we made younger Catholics a priority. And that filled up the place. And then we built it, at least on Sunday, we built it on three pillars. Gracious hospitality, singable music, and good preaching.
Mm.
Those are the three. And ironically, we, meaning clergy, Wall and Cusick, were really only on for one part of that, the preaching.
Yeah.
But you get people who are crack musicians, and people love good music.
Yeah.
And you get gracious hospitality. Catholics are not known for hospitality. You know, people just sort of walk in. You don't know who's there. We didn't begin Catholic Mass, and we still don't over there, with a procession and an opening song and all of the stereotypic thing. We ask people to stand, look around, find someone you've never met before, extend your name, and where you're from.
Wow.
And that just began conversations. And it's amazing. I did it that way this morning, and you have a hard time quieting people down because they just start getting gabby.
Yeah.
And people feel like, hey, I belong. And so I would always say, you can walk in here knowing nobody, but I guarantee you, you will not leave knowing nobody. You will have met at least one other person.
It was incredibly rewarding for you, your years there.
Oh, it still is. Yeah. I mean, it's life-giving.
How often are you there now?
Once a month.
Any specific?
No, it's I just tell them the Sundays I'm available, and
They pick one. They squeeze you in.
Well, sort of, you know, but that's okay. I mean, I had my time there. I've been retired 11 years. I'm honored to be able to come back and preside at Mass once a month.
And you also are called upon during the course of a year to minister to the grandchildren of people who were once your parishioners who were getting married, to the grandparents of parishioners who have died. I mean, it's a lot of joyful and necessary life end stuff.
I have a privileged, I call it a profession, I have a privileged profession. People allow me into their lives at some of the most human and key moments in life.
Yeah.
I presided at a memorial service the other day. A gentleman who passed away was 90. I knew him for the last 54 years.
Wow.
And the one who was sort of in charge of everything was his son, who did a great job. He was in sixth grade when I came on the scene. And here he is, president of a trucking company that his grandfather built, and he's now in his 60s. And he said, my dad wanted you, meaning me.
Mm.
And I said, well, I was honored to be able to come today and preside at some service. So, yeah, it goes around, comes around. It's all different kind of key things in life. And I'm just humbled to be able to be a part of people's lives. I think it's an important thing.
Your time at Old St. Pat's coincides with a very, very, very difficult time with the Catholic Church in America.
Oh.
When that kind of news, how did you deal with that, John? I mean, how did you deal with... You know, I'm thinking of Cardinal Cody's mistress, and I'm thinking of, you know, stuff like that, that obviously was absolutely foreign to you.
Well, it was, but there were two things going on simultaneously. The people in a local parish always loved their priests.
Mm-hmm.
Always.
Yeah.
And in the height of scandals, they were there for you in spades. When you stepped out of that environment, and you were in the general public, it was a whole different thing.
Uh-huh.
It's like Deer Hunter.
You know,
everybody who saw one of us roaming in a Roman collar saw us with having a bullseye. You know, here's another one of them.
Exactly.
And yet, on Sunday or at St. Pat's, it was just the exact opposite.
Mm-hmm.
And it was still always life-giving and very, very rewarding.
Yeah.
And... it was great. You know, I don't think it's an issue that's ever going to go away. Humanity is humanity.
Yep.
But at the same time, you got to have a support system for anything in life.
Sure.
You know, so that's how we weathered it.
Are there enough, and this is me, I meant to generalize this answer, are there enough young priests coming up now, some compared to the time you were in seminary?
No.
Not at all.
No, I mean, a couple of years ago, the Archdiocese of Chicago ordained four guys.
No.
My class was 31.
Wow.
So there's a big change.
Yeah.
You know.
Well, because the world has changed, too, and there are all these other inducements where you see, you know, all you have to do is sit in front of a computer and make $800,000 a year or something.
Oh, yeah. Everything has changed. I like to say, just using COVID as the example all the time, nothing is the same as before COVID. Everything has changed. I don't know one thing that's the same. Everything has changed. How people work, how they do every other kind of thing.
How they dress.
What their values are. It's just all changed. And you have to live with it. You have to make the best out of it. And I happen to be in a profession where you're involved in some of the most fundamental things in life. I mean, beginning with life itself.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, I always enjoy baptizing little kids, because I see a mom or a dad, they're holding on to the future of the world.
Huh.
You know, yeah. I mean, I can see some big kind of a bruiser guy who's afraid that if he walks in church, lightning will come flying out of his butt, you know, and everything, scared to death. But he's holding on to a son or a daughter. And it's like it's like a piece of glass that is expensive. It's his child. And he can look at that child in a way he cannot look at any other human being. And I'm so privileged to be there.
Wow.
I mean, I think it's just a wonderful thing.
Wow.
You know, I saw people today at church, you know, coming up with their little kids. And I like to always put my hand on the little kids and say, may God bless you. Because they're carrying the future. And my job on Sunday is to inspire people to do great things with their lives. I'm like a coach.
Well, that's well put.
I mean, I really believe that. I am not some brilliant intellectual. I'm not very smart. I never was. I was a C student, but I've got...
But smarts don't always come with idiot teachers giving grades.
Well, I know that, but I just want to affirm people. I want to build them up, call them in God's name to do something great with their life. And I never get tired of doing that.
We're going to take one last break, and we're going to then come back and talk about what you can do. John and I have always had, I haven't had a problem with people becoming religious, you know, around this time of year, because, oh my God, I can be saved if I buy the right Christmas tree or I buy the right, you know, the right ornament or something. We will be back in a couple of minutes. John Cusick and I have just decided that whatever that game, what is it called?
Pickleball.
Pickleball is a merging, an unholy merging between tennis and checkers. That's mine. John, at this time of year, of course, people are drawn to church and to religion and trying to be good. I suppose that's not a bad thing, but how does one keep it up? How does one... Do you have any suggestions?
Well, I was talking about that today at church. You know, I was saying we're being bombarded these days with I can't tell you how many pieces of mail I get from every organization in the world that's a not-for-profit looking for some of my money. And then television and radio and all these ads that... They can stir up a guilt machine.
Exactly, exactly.
And I've been on this journey inside of myself that I shared an episode today. It's too long to get into now. But I tried to help out a kid very anonymously on the near south side of Chicago many years ago. And I was going to quietly pay his tuition to a Catholic high school. He lasted 2 months. Priest called me up and said, he's gone.
Mm.
And I said, what do you mean he's gone? He was lost to the streets.
Ugh.
And we know what that means in Chicago. And I went on to say today, I'm looking for something about the inside of myself that I'm not responding to an ad and I'm not responding to a time of the year, but I'm looking for something inside of John Cusick that works in March, April, May, June, any month of the year. So I'm not driven by guilt, and I'm not driven by generosity. I want to be just oriented that somehow that my Catholic value system is operational to encourage people to be their best self. And at the same time, I can be my better self.
Yeah.
And it's nobody else's business. I told people today, I said, I don't know what it's going to be, but it's going to be personal to me. But I have to figure out something.
You are right, though, about the number of seductions that one is assaulted with at this time of year, with, you know, horrible and sometimes really horrible pictures of animals in distress or
everything,
little children starving, and it's terribly manipulative. I mean, I'm all for charity, but in that kind of, it's guilt tripping, isn't it?
Yeah, it is, and I think it makes us. I can't speak for anybody else. It makes me very vulnerable. I mean, I live in a city where, particularly very early in the morning, I'm talking like when I turn the radio on at 4 a.m. I'm not up, but I turn on the radio, and I swear to God, for first 2 minutes of the news, it's like, this is what happened in Vietnam overnight.
Yep.
And yep. It's the shootings and the killings and the auto accidents and this, that. And I'm getting weary at 4 o'clock in the morning. And then I feel so powerless as we shut down the Dan Ryan Expressway for the third time in 8 days.
Yeah, yeah.
Things like that, because somebody's out there shooting each other. And I'm thinking, this is not God's world. This is not what I've given my life to. But I don't know what to do about it. And the worst thing inside of me is when I feel powerless.
Well, I think many people, especially in this city now, I think many people with the wherewithal have decided to take it upon themselves to leave the city. I mean, they can afford to move, and they
right.
think, okay, it'd be better living in, next door to Mar-a-Lago. But most people are stuck here.
Well, and I think the other thing among most people, no matter where they live, the world has changed.
Yes.
And you cannot run from violence.
No.
And I think the violence that sometimes bothers me the most is the vulgarity that comes from people's lips,
mm-hmm.
the way they talk about other people, the lack of any kind of human respect. There's no values out there right now. And I've tried to lead a valued life and preach a valued life because I believe in it. And I will not give in to the lowest form of American life. And did I see it in this last campaign season?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, my God.
Yeah.
How ugly life had become.
Mm-hmm.
Among good people.
Yeah. Yeah.
But they've given in. They don't stand for what they were taught. They just don't. They would never teach their kid to speak like many people in public life today. They wouldn't teach their kid to do that, and yet they do it themselves. I go crazy.
I think it's strange, and we could talk about this for weeks on the show, but it's a strange kind of philosophical bent here where I think people think there's some kind of inherent power in being able to cut down or diminish another person or a group of people.
I would like a church full of those people on Christmas Eve, because we can talk a whole alternate way of looking at life through the story of the birth of Christ.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's the fundamental values of life, the fundamental respect for humanity that we are discarding. And good people are discarding it, because all of a sudden, I'm right.
Yeah.
And it's not about right. It's about respect.
And it's also not about me, me, me.
Right.
It's about us.
Exactly.
Don't you agree?
Oh, it's always a mutual thing. It's all about all of us. It's a corporate reality. And I will not give up on that. I just won't. But I struggle a lot. But that's why Christmas always gives me hope, because it's grounded in the human experience. And we proclaim it every year that it can be better than it is. But then all of a sudden it's January, and then it's February, and then it's March, and the whole damn thing is gone.
Yeah.
No, no, no. We've got to preserve the best of what humanity can be. I firmly believe that.
Well, as one of Studs Terkel's books was titled, from an ancient saying, hope dies last.
Right.
Hope dies last. John Cusick, it is an ongoing pleasure to know you, an ongoing treat to talk to you. We haven't had drinks in a long time, but that
no,
too,
we need to do
but that.
That
too, ladies and gentlemen, is one of my great ongoing pastimes. You take care of yourself, so you may indeed be going to see the Royko show.
Right. I hope I do, and I hope I can come back and talk to you again, because
you can. Eventually, football season will end. There will be time to talk on the radio.
Well, football season for many of us ended about 4 weeks ago.
Well, that's true. You got a point
but
there.
I'm teasing you there.
You got a point there, John. But, safe travels home.
Yes. Thank you. And honored to have this opportunity.
Oh, there's no honor here.
No, there is.
You're the most popular guest in the history of WGN Radio. You are.